everybody take their seats. If everybody in the audience could stop talking, we're going to bring the meeting to order and start out with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mallory.
Here.
Gauthier.
Here.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty. Johnson.
Here.
Kelly.
Here.
Kiefer.
Here.
Kreisel.
Here.
Leidiger.
Here.
Mariani. McDonald.
Ooh.
Moran.
Here.
Nornis.
Here.
Slocum.
Here.
Smith.
Okay, a quorum being present, would somebody entertain a motion here for the approval of the minutes from April 27th?
So moved.
Okay, Representative Kreisel moves the minutes of April 27th. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, minutes approved. Members, we held over Representative Barrett's bill 358 for today. I'll move bring it back in the for consideration, House File 358. And what we're going to do is we had four people left. Public testimony is closed. We had four people left that wanted to talk, and they're the only ones that will, and it's Representative Mallory, Grunhagen, Kiefer, and Moran. And when we open it up for discussion, it'd be just brief comments. I'll give you a couple, 3 minutes apiece, and because we get into our next bill here, and we've got an overflow room. For those of the people outside or listening, the overflow room is room 200 with video capability, I guess. So I was supposed to announce that. So on House File 358, Representatives Mallory, followed by Grunhagen, Kiefer, and Moran, and a couple of minutes each would be great, and then we'll take a vote. Representative Mallory.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not going to go over the things that others on our side have spoken about, other than that this is a real danger to the privacy of many people in many cities in Minnesota and their safety. But I want to get into the apparent enormous problems that we're causing, which haven't been really discussed very much. They were touched on, but they didn't have much time for testimony, and that's issues regarding data privacy. The general concept of privacy seems to be overridden totally here, and you do have a constitutional right to that. It probably interferes with compliance with both ordinance and laws, which will lead to a lot of problems. We could have a teacher that starts wanting to look into data on family of students on public time. So apparently by this law, they can do that rather than teaching. It gets into the issue of what is data privacy now, and does this override all our rules on both privacy and data privacy? Does it, it seems to give any entity or any person the right to bring a lawsuit, so there could be all kinds of lawsuits on this, which will be an enormous problem for local governments. At the same time, we're cutting money for them from the state in every other area. Including this committee's omnibus bill cut some, not as bad as a lot of the other omnibus bills. But this is an area that wasn't even really discussed except briefly by the cities. And so I just think that we're charging away at something with an incredibly broad sledgehammer. It's kind of like if there's a bump on a glass vase, instead of filing it off, you take a sledgehammer to it and just destroy everything. So that's, I don't want to prolong things because I know you've got a big calendar. So
Thank you, Representative Mullery. Representative Grunhagen, a couple minutes.
Yep. Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, just from yesterday's discussion about showing an ID, I, you know, even as a school board member, the last year I was on, I had to bring an ID, either my birth certificate or a passport, up to the administrative office to prove I was even a citizen. When I became a state rep here and looked for an apartment, I had to show a picture ID to the people before they even showed me an apartment. So, I mean, I don't see it's that big of a burden to have to show an ID. If you're in a foreign country, as an American citizen, you go to a foreign country, you have to show proper identification, get it on and off the boat or the go through customs or whatever. I mean, that's just part of the process of our immigration laws. So the other thing is, like I said yesterday, our current system is broken. And I think one of the worst consequences to people is the illegal immigrants themselves. When we have weak laws that encourage illegal immigration, that bring them up here and then put them into a situation where they can be so easily exploited. We need strong laws against illegal immigration and support legal immigration, and that'll be better for everybody, and not perpetuate this system with weak laws and laws that in some ways encourage illegals to come up here and then put them in that situation where they are exploited. That was my comment from yesterday's discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. You finished 5 seconds under the limit. Thank you, Representative Green. Representative Kiefer, a couple minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've listened to this process, but I just want to share that there is a process in the United States, and I know immigrants, I know refugees, I know people that work here with visas and green cards, and there's a legal process to do so, and they follow the laws. I also want to share that I was a foreigner in a foreign land, and I never thought I was above the law. I always showed my documentation at the borders with the guards with their guns, and my little children had to do the same thing. I think it's disrespectful not to follow the laws. But what really, really impacted me yesterday was hearing testifiers, these women coming up one after another, sharing horrible stories about how they are forced under abuse and their children, and they are forced into prostitution. And I think it's time to send a clear message to the people who are doing this to these women and children that this type of behavior is not tolerated in our country and in our state and in our culture. And maybe we can talk about privacy issues, but if these people are abusing other members that are living in our cities, then something needs to be done. So I'd like to see House File 358 pass just to send a clear message that this behavior is not going to be tolerated anymore, and that we need to start a conversation. Thank you very much. I will be supporting this bill.
Thank you, Representative Kiefer. And Representative Moran, last for a couple minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember coming into this committee, you know, first couple of weeks, and time after time I heard police referenced as peace officers. And I remember saying that in my community, I'd never seen, or many people in my community, never seen the police as peace officers. You know, because the part of having that relationship is about having a relationship and having that trust with the police that you feel comfortable enough to trust them for your own safety. And this is a safety committee. It's nothing else. It's not about ID. It's not about relationship. It's not about, it's about safety. We had two police chiefs come to this committee and talk about how this would endanger the citizens of our state. And when they come here from Minneapolis and St. Paul, it's not just about Minneapolis and St. Paul. We are a city that are interconnected. What happens here will impact you wherever you are. And I cannot see how we as a committee who commitment is about protecting our citizens is going to allow this bill to come to this committee and pass when we have had the professionals, we have had peace officers tell us the impact that this bill will have on our citizens in the state of Minnesota. Now, I know we talked, Grunhagen, I'm sure Barrett, this is the bill that came about for many different reasons and purposes that we all talked about. But this bill, in its present form, the way it's created, is not going to, I don't see as how it's going to support your efforts, but in all, it is not going to create what we are here for, and that is to ensure that our citizens are protected in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Moran. That's the end of discussion. House file, I'll move House File 358. Did you want to move? House File 358 to be recommended to pass and move to the judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Ayes have it. Thank you, Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay, next non-controversial bill will be House File 1467. This will be my bill. So there's no confusion. What I'm going to do here is lay out the ground rules. What we want to do is be fair and allow. What's going to happen is after I give out the ground rules, I'm going to approach the testimony table, do a short presentation, and let an attorney friend of mine present the bill in detail, and then we will move to the opposition. The opposition will have 30 minutes, and the supporters will have 30 minutes, and then we'll move into a discussion and a vote by the end of today. We will not leave without voting. Now, could everybody in the opposition please raise their hand? Okay, now look around on the opposition. You folks get together and figure out how many are going to testify and how many are going to not need to testify. They're just going to be redundant because you will have 30 minutes as a group. What that means, if there's 10 people to testify and we're at number 7 and the 30 minutes is up, 3 people will not be allowed to testify. So that goes the same for our side. I'll cut ourselves off at 30 minutes. So if you could round up the people in opposition. So this is all fair. Realize that you've got 30 minutes, and when you're talking, if you can say what you got to say in 2 minutes, that would be great. If it's as simple as, I don't like the bill, you know, vote no, and the same with the support. So having said that, we will enforce the time limit, and if we keep talking, we'll be gaveled out of order and then proceed to the next. And I'll take the table and present the bill.
And just one more further clarification on the ground rules for this bill. We do have a list of folks who have already come to us to testify, and we're going to start off with that list. And then if as Chair Cornish has mentioned, anybody else wants to testify, please find the page. They're over here in this corner, and get your name on the list, because as Chair Cornish mentioned, once that 30 minutes is up, we'll keep moving. So Chair Cornish, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move House File 1467 be recommended to pass and move to judiciary.
Okay. Chair Cornish recommends this bill pass and be recommended to pass to judiciary. That's House File number 1467. Chair Cornish, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, my presentation is going to be very brief. This thing has been probably vetted out in the papers and the media for years. It's a bill long overdue. The main crux of it started out, I think, a few years ago as the Castle Doctrine, and it's had a lot of derogatory names. We'd like to refer it now to a self-defense bill. That's one of the sections in the bill. It allows a person in a home or dwelling and other areas your legal right to be some amount of making up your own mind what type of force you're going to use and how much to repel an invader or a threat. That's basically it. I would encourage everybody to keep their seats today because the opposition will come up, and if it's anything like the claims that have been made in the paper and the media and some of the emails, well, many of them are false and just downright lies. And so it would be interesting if you can stay in your seat to listen to both sides and hear the support afterwards, and then just make up your own mind on what is real and what is imagined here. Another section of the bill is reciprocity with permits, handgun permits with other states. Another one is emergency powers doctrine. It basically, our law, what it says, when law enforcement can or cannot take a weapon from a person that they perceive as a threat to themselves or to the officer, cover a number of subjects there. And then we also extend the handgun permit to purchase from 1 year to 5. We don't get rid of any of the background checks. We don't degrade the law at all for any background or safety in this bill. All we do is extend the duration. Also, there's a portion of the bill that directs folks to be sending more information to the National Information Center on Crime so that more people are in that database. If there's some information that isn't getting sent in right now, we're trying to correct that. We're trying to tighten up the system, actually, for people that shouldn't have firearms. So this bill not only deals in safety to yourself, but to the general public, and to make sure the people that get guns really should have them. I think it's a good bill. It's a common sense bill. I'm going to have a friend of mine, Mr. Gross, come up and present the bill section by section, if that's okay with the chair.
Thank you, Chair Cornish, and please state your name for the record.
My name is David M. Gross. I'm from Faribault, Minnesota.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Gross.
I think Tony might have asked me to present the bill because of my 18 years of prosecution experience here in the cities. I won't be extremely technical. Let me just jump right in. Article 1 is about providing more information to, and the only change that's made is the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, commonly known as NICS, in Washington, or under the control of the FBI. We have the NICS check. It's been in effect for a while. As I understand it, the Commissioner of Human Services of the state of Minnesota wanted express authorization to share specific Minnesota data on its citizens with Washington, D.C., and this gives it to them, so that we participate fully in the NICS background check system. End of discussion. There's an it does list the data, August 1, 1994. It lists that date. The reason that date is used is that's when DHS was given the authority to provide that data to MNCIS. It's that simple. It requires the courts and allows the courts to provide pretrial diversion information and gross misdemeanor conviction disqualification information in the same fashion. So it's ensuring full participation in the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. That's Article 1. There is a, it isn't Article 1. Section 3 talks about the permits to purchase. It supplies the same authority and instruction to conduct a criminal background check system in the same manner as under a permit to carry. I'm sorry. And that's in, that begins, that section begins on page, well, then I have to go back and forth. That happens beginning on page 2, line 2.30, and continues through line 2.28, and then the permit to purchase is extended to 5 years, beginning on line 3.10 in section 4. And the reason for that is efficiency, cost savings, and also less hassle. It does require that annually, on a 5-year extended permit to purchase, that the police chief run an annual background check electronically in the exact same manner as for a permit to carry. And it avoids having to apply every year. And if it works for a permit to carry, it should work for a permit to purchase, too. There are some people who do not want a permit to carry for whatever reason. It's not that they couldn't qualify and train for it. It's just that they don't want one. That's freedom of choice. But they have to have a way of certifying that there is a background check that's been conducted on them, and they go to their police chief or their sheriff as appropriate for the certification that a criminal background check has been conducted upon them and that it has been annually updated, at least annually updated. The police chief or the sheriff can run that electronic background check at least annually. They could run it daily if they wanted. And it's done, again, it's done in a batch mode through computers. Why are we doing this? Because we have experience, and available to you is a listing of those people who've complained. We have the background check and the certification thereof is supposed to be done in 7 days from the application. And we have documented instances of going up to, you know, a couple of months. Why? Well, because there's no teeth in the bill. No teeth in the right that you have it done in 7 days. Police chief holds it, sheriff holds it, says I'll get around to it when I want to, when it's convenient for me. Well, that's not how public servants are supposed to be. I have just recently my son-in-law, who does not have a permit to carry, bought a gun at Allman's Gun Shop out there in Morristown. He lives in Faribault. In order to go pick it up and take possession, he needed a permit to purchase, a certification of his criminal background check that he passed it. So he applied and he got a receipt. After 2 weeks, he called up the police chief and he said, "What's going on? Why haven't I heard from you?" And he says, "I haven't gotten a return on the information on my individual inquiry from the Department of Human Services."
Mr. Gross, and I understand that this is good testimony, but I want to make sure that we have time for both the opposition, and if you could just run through the bill for us as all opposed right. to going into the...
There's experiential you. Support for the need to put some teeth
cover
into
that
it.
Rebuttal.
Yep, I'll handle that. There's Article 2, authority to seize weapons. This is based, the need for it came out of Hurricane Katrina. We had numerous lawsuits, violations of civil rights by people in the aftermath of Katrina. It cost Louisiana a fortune. You can say, as it should have, we want to stop that here so that the police don't have the ability to suspend the Constitution of the United States or the Constitution of the state of Minnesota in a alleged state of emergency. That's it. Self-defense. Now, you're going to be told that this is a shoot-first bill. That's a lie. This bill does not suspend and, in fact, reauthorizes in Subdivision 2 of Article 3 the requirement that a person act reasonably and upon a factual basis. You have to have a reason to act in self-defense. It's not shoot first. It's not shoot on a whim. You have to reasonably believe certain things or have certain facts be true. You don't go shooting at shadows. None of the stuff that they claim unintended consequences applies. You'll hear about it. It details the circumstances when the use of force is authorized. It indicates, it details what degree of force and when you must retreat to avoid the use of force. It directs the criminal investigation, if any, into an incident where force is used. And fundamentally what it says is that if there is probable cause to believe that an individual acted in a justifiable manner and did something that they had to do that they didn't want to do, they acted in self-defense, it shifts the burden of the focus of the inquiry to the criminal and not to the innocent citizen who acted in self-defense. So you don't arrest the gun anymore. You arrest the perpetrator.
Mr. Gross, I'm going to give you two more minutes to get through this last article here.
Recognition of other states' permits to carry. It basically says that if a permit to carry is good enough for another state, it'll be good enough for the state of Minnesota. All permits to carry in other states go through the NICS background check just like ours does. There may be some difference in the training requirement. Okay. But if it's good enough for the public carry in other states, and they are, then it's good enough for us, like a driver's license, and you are still subject to Minnesota law. Minnesota law applies in every instance. So when you're in Minnesota with an out-state permit to carry, you do as Minnesotans do, and you're subject to the same restrictions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gross. I think I've got a question from Representative Moran. Is this to the testifier? Okay, thank you.
All right. I guess I'm done for the moment.
Representative Moran?
We didn't understand. I'm sorry. We didn't understand from Representative Cornish if we were supposed to wait with questions so that each gets exactly their 30 minutes, and maybe since time is such an issue, maybe that's the best way to do it. The only problem is if maybe the testifiers would stay fairly close so they could be called on later, and then do we get a chance to at least discuss it afterwards? Those two questions I've been asked.
Representative Murray, I'm okay with that. I'd like to kind of use the members' discretion and asking questions of the testifier and making sure that they're to the point when we do that. And if that fails as we move forward, we can move back to a different structure. Chair Cornish?
If we could hold off in the questions, because we were given a hard time yesterday for not allowing enough time, even though every single person got to testify on the time limit. So we'd like to give everybody their time today. So if we could hold questions, write them down, and we'll keep the testifiers right around here.
I'm okay with that as well, Chair Cornish. That's fine. Okay. Let's do that, and then we'll get through the testifiers. We may have to have them walk back down if you have a specific question, but that way we can get through the testifiers. Thank you, Chair Cornish. Thank you, Mr. Gross. First person we have on the list is Christopher Rager.
Which name did you call him?
I'm sorry, Christopher Rager.
No, that's the support. We're going through the opposition first for 30 minutes.
All right, let's see. Who's number one on the out? John? John? Joseph Olson, are you here for support or in opposition to?
Support.
Okay, so hold on there, John. Todd Miller, are you here in opposition or support? Okay. Jim Backstrom, are you here for opposition or support? Okay, Jim, you're up. And Mr. Backstrom, if you can just give us your name for the record, please. And one more little piece of housekeeping. Since we're going to hold questions for testifiers, if you can, you know, remain either at the end of your seats or over here by the elevator where we can call you if members have questions after we hear from all the testimony. Okay, and we're going to limit it to about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney. I am here today to testify in opposition to this bill. It is a rare occurrence when I testify in opposition to a bill from Representative Cornish, who I have great respect for, but this is one of those instances. While no one is more concerned about the safety and protection of Minnesota citizens than I am as one of our state's prosecutors, I believe the current Minnesota law establishing the right of self-defense and the justified use of deadly force adequately protects our law-abiding citizens. It is important to understand that today a person can use deadly force in our state without an obligation to retreat if that is done to prevent the commission of a felony that occurs in their home. When a person is not in their home, they can rightfully protect themselves by using deadly force to avert a threat or death of death or great bodily harm to themselves or another, provided that the person first attempts to avoid the danger if reasonably possible. In all situations, under current Minnesota law, our statutes properly require that the response when deadly force is used be reasonable and necessary, given the gravity of the situation. That, I believe, is the way the law should be. House File 1467 would eliminate the duty to retreat before exercising the right of self-defense in all locations. It would permit a person to meet force with superior force, including deadly force, if that individual reasonably believes such force is needed to resist or prevent the imminent infliction of substantial bodily harm, great bodily harm, or death. This proposal creates a presumption that deadly force can be used against someone who enters a dwelling by force or stealth, and it expands significantly the definition of dwelling under our law. This proposal, in my opinion, inappropriately creates a subjective standard of reasonableness of the actions rather than the objective standard that exists under current law. In other words, the issue becomes what was in the mind of the person using deadly force rather than how a reasonable person would have reacted under the same circumstances. Such a law would, in essence, allow a person to shoot first and ask questions later whenever they believe they are exposed to substantial harm, regardless of how a reasonable person would have responded under the circumstances or would have perceived the gravity of the danger presented. If this proposal is enacted, I believe there will be numerous examples of situations where reasonable persons would never shoot to kill someone, but viable self-defense claims could be raised. Do we really want, as a society, to allow a driver who believes he's being threatened with substantial harm in a road rage incident to shoot and kill the other driver rather than calling 911 or simply driving away? Do we really want the law to presume that a homeowner will have the right to shoot and kill an unarmed teenager who has entered a garage to steal a bicycle or other personal property? Do we really want to authorize the use of deadly force in response to a push, punch, or a verbal threat without any inquiry as to whether a reasonable person would have done so under the circumstances? I believe the answer to those questions should be no. Another problem with the stand your ground and shoot first expansion of the right to use deadly force under our law would be that it would apply equally to dangerous criminals in our society. For example, it would allow rival gang members to shoot and kill without any duty to retreat when involved in a gang confrontation that imminently exposes those gang members to the risk of substantial harm and death. And I would submit to you that there are few gang confrontations that don't carry those consequences.
Mr. Bashram, just a reminder that your 2 minutes are up. I'm going to give you about 15 more seconds.
Okay, with no duty to retreat, anyone can claim that they are responding to a serious threat of harm and are therefore justified in escalating the confrontation and killing other persons. And keep in mind, under this proposal, it's their judgment, not that of a reasonable person that's controlling. For all of those reasons, I would encourage this legislature, this committee and the legislature not to adopt this proposal. I also would like to express publicly my concerns about the expansion of the permit to carry pistols provisions in this bill. I believe they're inappropriate to allow the rules in other states, the least restrictive rules in other states, to apply here in Minnesota. We should have our law apply here in our state, and I am also concerned about the extension of the background checks under the permit to carry. Thank you.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Backstrom. And Heather Martins. And next on the list, just so you're ready, is Joan Peterson. And Ms. Martins, welcome to the committee. It's good to see you. And please state your name for the record.
Yes, Heather Martins, Executive Director of Protect Minnesota, working to end gun violence.
Ms. Martins, might I have you repeat that? Just make sure we got the recording.
Okay, Heather Martins, Executive Director of Protect Minnesota, working to end gun violence. So I'm here in opposition. This a law about something as important as the use of deadly force should pass the plain English test. This proposal does not. There is a presumption in this bill that people will be talking about and saying, no, that presumption doesn't mean that you can kill a kid who's come into your yard to steal a bicycle. But actually, how is the average layperson supposed to understand this presumption? And when they read this, do they know what a curtilage is? Do they know what an appurtenance is? And do they know what by force and by stealth is by legal definitions? I think not. The existing statute is about 50 words, and it's very clear. It says, if you don't have to kill somebody, you're not entitled to. And that's a moral standard that Minnesota has. And there will be discussion about whether that presumption is rebuttable. If you want it to be rebuttable, you should say so in this bill, because in Florida, they didn't. And it's being presumed not rebuttable in Florida. And in Florida, there are many cases where there are no charges being filed when people are shot. I'd like to point out, this is a picture of Rachel Berezinski. She was a cheerleader and homecoming queen. She was 17 when she and her friends went looking for ghosts in the cemetery one night next to Alan David's house. Davis's house was a local haunted house, or so the kids thought. That night, Davis heard a noise outside, but he couldn't see anything, so he pointed his rifle out the window and fired, hitting Rachel Berezinski in the head. Davis went to jail for this because Ohio didn't have shoot first. Here's what Davis had to say about it. It's really something how homeowners defend themselves, and the way the laws are written, we're the ones brought up on charges while the perpetrators get little or nothing. That's a quote in the newspaper. That's exactly what you're going to be hearing today from the proponents of this bill. People who say these things want to point their guns out the window into the darkness and fire, and they don't want to be held responsible for who they hit.
I would ask, I understand that this is a very interesting debate we're having here this morning, but if you could keep your comments in the crowd to yourself, please. Thank you.
Trespassing is not a capital offense for a reason. The reason is that kids should be able to make mistakes and still grow up. Ben Foster, an Iowa campaign staffer for former Governor Tim Pawlenty, is another example of who could get shot if this bill becomes law. Foster had a bit too much to drink a few weeks ago and went to a stranger's back door at 3 a.m. He thought he was at a friend's house, but he scared a 15-year-old half to death. His arm was in my back door trying to get in, and I screamed. And I went upstairs to my parents' room, and I continued screaming, said Chloe Stewart. He shoved his arm in here and kept touching the wall, looking for something. I don't know what he was looking for. Chloe's dad came down with a gun, but Iowa doesn't have shoot first, so he didn't shoot. He held Ben Foster till police arrived. Ben Foster is still alive.
Ms. Martin,
in Texas, that
you're
kind of thing.
2 minutes, so you've got 15 seconds.
Well, in Texas, that kind of restraint is a quaint thing of the past. Actually, I thought you said we as a whole had 30 minutes.
Well, we want to make sure that we've got plenty of room for the other testifiers that are on here, and that once we're up with 30 minutes, we're done. So just out of respect for the rest of the testifiers, we've limited it.
I think I have one more minute. based on that division of minutes, 3 minutes per testifier.
I'm going to give you 15 seconds, Ms. Martins. We really want to get to the rest of these testifiers and make sure everybody has 30 minutes.
In Texas, that kind of restraint is a quaint thing of the past. Carter Albrecht did the exact same thing. He was pounding on a neighbor's door in the middle of the night because he was having an adverse drug reaction to a smoking cessation drug. The homeowner fired through the door, killing Carter Albrecht, and there were no charges filed because Texas has shoot first. In Florida, nobody tracks how many people are never charged with a crime. But according to the Orlando Sentinel, the disparities in how different cases are handled are huge. Some are not investigated at all. Others are investigated for 20 hours. These examples are not stranger attacks that proponents are talking about. They are longstanding neighbor disputes, drunk people at the wrong door, and mentally ill people acting strangely. We don't think testy neighbors, drunk people, or kids playing pranks deserve to die. Some say I should not pick on Florida because it's not the Wild West. I'd agree. Florida is much worse. Florida's gun homicide rate has doubled since 2000 to 935. That's five times the rate of gun homicide in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidiger,
we'd like to sure that the members have time at the end.
Thank you, Representative Leidiger. Ms. Martins, I've given you more than one more minute than you requested against my initial judgment of 15 seconds. So wrap
it
up.
We don't need this bill. Please vote no.
Thank you, Ms. Martins. Next, we've got Joan Peterson. And Joan, and after Joan, we have Mary Ellison. And so, Mary, if you can be, Ms. Ellison, if you can be prepared for being next. Thank you. And we are 10 minutes into the 30 minutes for the opposition. And Ms. Nelson, if you can state your name for the record, please.
My name is Joan Peterson. I am a member of the Board of Directors of Protect Minnesota and the National Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. I'm also a member of the Domestic Abuse Intervention Programs Board of Directors, which is situated in Duluth. And I'm co-president of the Northland chapter of the Brady Campaign. I need to start out by saying, first, Chair Cornish, I do resent being called a liar before I've even appeared before you to make my remarks. And so now I will make my remarks. I'm here specifically to testify against Article 3, self-defense colon use of force. Allow me to flesh out the consequences of this provision by telling you a personal story. My sister Barbara Lund and her friend Kevin went to the Minnetonka home of her estranged husband, Russell Lund, on August 5th, 1992, to deliver some documents. There had been a long and contentious divorce. She was concerned for her safety because of the nature of the divorce proceedings, so she did not want to go alone. Everything after this is pieced together by law enforcement and my now deceased former brother-in-law in words to his lawyers and others who came into contact with him after he shot two innocent people, one of them being my sister. There were no witnesses. What happened that August day is only what we heard from him and evidence gathered at the crime scene. Barbara and Kevin came to the house. They were unarmed. They were invited inside. Somehow they ended up in the basement. They were each shot three times, killing them both. There was no evidence of a struggle. There were no witnesses. Russell Lund said later that he felt intimidated by them. No one knows what really happened. The rest is hypothetical, since Russell Lund killed himself in the psychiatric ward of the Fairview Southdale Hospital several months after the shooting. So here is the rest of the tale as it could unfold under the proposal before you now. Russell claims under line 6.24 of number 2 of subdivision 2 that he was resisting what he reasonably believed to be an offense or attempted offense that imminently exposed him to substantial bodily harm or death. Remember, there were no witnesses. They were dead. Also pertinent to my story is subdivision 3, degree of force, retreat, line 634 and 635. Quote, that the individual honestly and in good faith believes is required to succeed in defense. It's up to him to decide that. Next, subdivision 5, criminal investigation, immunity from prosecution, line 7.26 and 7.27. Russell is, quote, justified in using such force and is immune from any civil liability or criminal prosecution for that act, unquote. Last, no trial by jury, no justice, no way for my family to have closure, and now Russell is free to walk among us having shot two people to death. What kind of a system would this be? What would my mother, now dead, in her 70s at the time, do with the idea that her beloved oldest child was killed by a man who will not walk free? who will now watch.
You're at the 2-minute mark, so I'm going to give you a little bit of additional time, but 15 to 20 seconds.
Please. You get the idea. We don't need this bill. It will not make us safer. A vote of yes means you are willing to live with the ambiguous and confusing language of this bill. I urge you to vote no on this bill. Victims' rights will be taken away. People will be allowed to shoot somebody and get away with murder. Thank you for listening to my remarks.
Thank you for testimony, Ms. Peterson. And Ms. Ellison is next. And then next on the list would be Ms. Conlon. Ms. Ellison, please state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And basically, I'm here today to explain the reciprocity process that we currently use, since there's some suggested changes to that process. So under current law, we are to annually establish and publish a list of other states that have laws for issuance of permits to carry that are not substantially similar to our law. The way that we have implemented this law is that substantially similar means that they would be eligible for a permit under Minnesota law as it exists. So we conduct that review yearly in June, and currently we have 15 states with reciprocity, and we have 35 states with which we do not have reciprocity. So again, that's just clarification for the current process. I would certainly answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Ellison. Next on the list is Ms. Conlon. And following Ms. Conlon is Mr. Pucha. And Ms. Conlon, if you can state your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Katie Conlon, Interim Social Concerns Director at the Minnesota Catholic Conference. The Catholic Conference is the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota, and I'm here to express some concern about portions of House File 1467. In particular, we're concerned about Article 3, which would make changes to Minnesota's self-defense law. We understand that this section seeks to clarify Minnesota's law on the use of force and when killing someone in defense of people or property is justifiable. We want to draw your attention to the history behind the law of self-defense and use of force in hopes that this will help guide your decision-making. If I run out of time, I did distribute written copies, so you have my full testimony. When and how much force an individual can use against another is ultimately a moral question. We ask that each of you evaluate whether the language of House File 1467 moves us closer to or further from the fundamental moral principles that create a culture of life and peace. These fundamental principles are found in sacred scripture and have served as a foundation of civil society for thousands of years. The Bible presents the precept, "You shall not kill," as a divine commandment. And people of different faiths and people of no faith at all accept this injunction because of the inherent value of all human life. From this precept comes a principle, a fundamental principle, that no one can claim a right to deliberately kill an innocent human being. This fundamental principle leads to a second principle. The determination of guilt and the authority to punish is limited to duly appointed public authorities. These two principles have guided the development of law in the Western world for thousands of years. How these principles guide our understanding of self-defense has been debated and discussed for centuries. Thomas Aquinas explained the relationship as follows. It is never permissible for a private individual to intentionally kill a person, even in cases of self-defense. A person can, however, use moderate force to repel an aggressor when it is necessary to do so in order to protect oneself or someone for whom the person is responsible. If use of force meets these conditions and the aggressor dies as a result, the person acting in defense is not guilty of murder. The aggressor's death is a double effect. That is, there is an intended effect of protection and an unintended effect of a killing. In implying these principles, English common law found a duty to retreat, since the use of deadly force cannot be necessary if the person can escape. In 2001, the Minnesota Supreme Court made clear that Minnesota has adopted a castle doctrine, removing that duty to retreat from one's own home in self-defense. The court concluded
that... Ms. Conlon, you're at the 2-minute mark, so you got the 15-second warning.
I'm going to skip ahead. Thank you. What we're concerned about is... Earlier, there was mentioned that there's a change from an objective to a subjective standard. And that's one of the biggest concerns, I think, that we have about this bill, is that what kind of a standard do we want people to be applying when they are choosing to defend themselves? And we ask whether the subjective standard is truly the correct one to be going with. And we also wanted to ask whether or not the creation of presumptions that there was a reasonable belief in imminent substantial harm whenever somebody's attempting to enter by stealth or by force, really aligns well with the principles that have guided self-defense law for so very long in Western civilization. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Collin. And Mr. Pechia. And followed by Mr. Reed. I apologize for the continuous butchering of your name.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it pleases the Chair, what we'd like to do is pool our 6 minutes and have representatives from law enforcement express our opposition with me as Executive Director Denny Flaherty of the MPPOA and Assistant Chief Ken Reed of the St. Paul Police Department.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I am Dave Peach. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, and I'm here to testify in opposition of this bill on the behalf of the members of our association. We have over 700 members, 331 of which are chiefs of police. And as you can tell by the author of the bill, we are all not opposed to this legislation, and there may be chiefs that will come up later and testify in support of it. Mr. Franklin, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, is unable to attend, but he has provided me with a letter that he'd like to share with the committee members in opposition to this bill. And on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, what I'd like to do is just provide a brief overview of our opposition to the bill and allow my colleagues to add more specifics to the opposition. In Article 1, the permit to purchase, I'd like to thank the committee for adding the background checks. We're just asking that the background checks that are allowed are consistent with our existing checks that we currently do. And also, we have some issues with notification of the permit holder in the event that they are in violation of the permit to acquire, and the statute doesn't allow a remedy for that. So what we're suggesting is that in the event that a permit holder would move from one jurisdiction to another, that they would reapply in the new jurisdiction to which they have moved. In Article 2, the authority to seize and confiscate firearms, I'm told this is based on the Katrina catastrophe. And it's hard to transfer the alleged actions of some of the citizens and government and police in New Orleans to the culture of Minnesota. Having said that, the language in this article appears to be overly broad, confusing, and affects local control and some zoning issues. On Article 3, in the self-defense and use of force, we oppose the expanded definition of a dwelling, the circumstances when authorized, the retreat provision, and presumptions as authorized by this article, including the burden of proof. Mr. Flaherty will go into more detail about the officer safety issue. On Article 4, the recognition of other states' permits to carry. As drafted, this would allow Minnesota citizens to circumvent the Minnesota standards of training and the existing expiration date and by applying for a permit from another state. Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Dennis Flaherty, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, which is a group comprised of about 8,500 rank-and-file police officers that work throughout the state of Minnesota. And I want to go on record in opposition to this bill. I just for time's sake, we are very concerned about the permits, the five-year proposal. It's great that it spells out a annual check, but unfortunately there's nothing in there that allows us to revoke the permit if we find some disqualifying factor that has occurred since the time of the application. There should be something in there that at minimum requires the permit holder to notify the issuing authority anytime they change the address. We do it on driver's licenses. In fact, it's a crime not to notify the department or the driver's folks when you change your address, but yet here we're not having any such requirement. And obviously we're concerned about not being able to remove firearms when we're called into domestic situations or situations that involve people that might not be in their best mental stability. Oftentimes, one of the spouses will ask that a firearm be taken into custody. We do so. We bring it into our station. We property inventory it, and we hold it, and they can come back and get it when temper's cool or when they're in a better position. This bill would prohibit that, and that is not in the best interest of public safety in Minnesota. And that will come back to haunt us. I'm very fearful of that. There are people that have states of mind that shouldn't have firearms, and to just temporarily relieve them, and now an officer could be sued if they were going to take that action. But I want to just focus on the part about the so-called castle doctrine. For us, as Mr. Peach says, it's an officer safety deal, and we're frightened by it. Because every day in every one of your districts, during daylight hours and during the nighttime, we have officers going on people's property. They are not invited and most often are not wanted. And they are there perhaps for an arrest warrant, a search warrant, and yes, maybe even a no-knock search warrant. And it is important that we have the element of surprise. It's critical. And it leads to apprehensions, but more importantly, it's for officer safety when you can surprise someone. And so, yes, we do forcibly enter homes by force and by stealth, and we're doing it lawfully by direction of a court. And we feel very, we're very concerned about what we're going to be met with, and unfortunately this law creates a scenario where we are going to have officers hurt or perhaps, God forbid, killed. And this is what we do for a living, and oftentimes we're not in full uniform, and this is what we do for a living, and so it's a problematic for us to say the least. And so I would hope that you would rethink that provision, because the defense in here just says, well, they have to know it's an officer. Well, they may not know, and so now they can kill anybody that's coming in. We do our best to let them know once we're in that we're police officers, but unfortunately, in too many times, we must go in and Mr.
Flaherty, your combined 6 minutes is up, but I, out of respect for the chief, I'm going to make sure that you still have time to speak. So, if you could wrap up.
I hope you would allow law enforcement to have this as our only opportunity, but I'll pass it on.
Thank you, Mr. Flaherty.
Thank you, sir. I heard you say I'd have an opportunity. I'll make it as brief as I can, okay?
Thank you, sir.
The St. Paul Police Department aggressively addresses violent crime, and as a result, our city is a safe city as compared with cities across the United States. We also support the Second Amendment of the Constitution, but having made those statements, I appreciate the committee's willingness to listen to our concerns. Quickly, on the permit to purchase renewal background checks, one addition we would request is that requiring human services to input commitment information into the electronic system in a commensurate time frame that we are asked within those 7 days to complete the permitting process. In regards to the five-year permitting, I would debate the efficiency and cost savings that was mentioned earlier. Under Section 3 in the amendment to 624-71317 Subdivision 2, with 1,200 permits being processed annually, and the BCA's numbers telling us that only 25% of permit applicants reapply annually, over 5 years we would have to do 75% of them for no reason whatsoever, and that's at about $80,000 per year. So that's inefficient at its best. One of the things in the permitting under Section 5, petitions for release, unless we missed it in our review, there is nothing in here that includes, that may render a person prohibited under the Domestic Abuse Act under Minnesota Statute 518B.01, Subdivision 14. That is very important to the St. Paul Police Department. We're heavily involved in domestic abuse enforcement and issues. And again, unless we missed it, that needs to be addressed. We have great concerns with the changes in 609.065, justifiable use of force. We're talking about death here. The definition of deadly force presumes that whatever is in one person's mind takes precedence over what may be in another person's mind, no matter the circumstances, without giving any consideration to the accuracy of their observations, their state of mind, their motive, their physical or mental state. As an ex-homicide detective, to put the burden on me to try to investigate something like that with the language that's in this provision is darn near impossible. And as you heard from the prosecutor, very difficult from their perspective as well. The expanded definition of dwelling, we see in its current form as a recipe for disaster and a safety issue for our citizens. Dwelling now includes areas where children commonly play, cavort, and encroach upon, and areas commonly accessed by delivery persons, meter readers, service workers, and our law enforcement officers. More assaults occur behind the threshold of a person's dwelling than within. Ex-spouses routinely visit homes, and disagreements happen every day. The language is too broad and will cause immeasurable problems for officers, investigators, and public attorneys.
I mean, Chief, we've got we've given you 3 minutes here, so.
Thank you, sir.
We'll give you a 15-second warning.
Very good. The term forcible felony and deadly weapon are new terms not adequately defined in the statutes at all. There's been examples given on how broadly that can now be defined or be interpreted. Again, in Section 1 there's no consideration given to the observations. What a drunk person thinks is reasonable is very different than what a sober person thinks, and the differentiation on that in the language is difficult. And I guess on the Castle Doctrine, that's long established law. It started in 1907, and the court decisions as recently as State v. Glowacki, they've ruled there's no duty to retreat in one's home, even if the aggressor is a co-resident. It's not necessary to change this.
Thank you, Chief. And I appreciate your testimony. And having kind of gone over our 30 minutes here slightly, and no one else on the list from the opposition, we're going to turn to support for the bill. And first on the list for that is Christopher Rager. And then second up after Christopher Rager is Andy Rothman. So if you can be ready, Mr. Rothman.
Mr. Chair.
You be yes, like Chair Cornish.
Change that order a little bit and bring up Todd Miller after I get done with a few comments.
Okay. Go ahead, Chair.
Mr. Chair and members, all law enforcement doesn't feel like that. I'm a chief of police, and I'm going to be followed by a chief of police. In my 36-year career, I've been assaulted, cut, shot at twice. I faced more guns in one fall as a game warden in northern Minnesota pointed at me than most of the cops here have in their entire career. And so all of us don't feel like that. There used to be an association called Cops Against Gun Control. And also, both the Sheriff's Association and the MPPOA had resolutions on prescribing not to prescribe laws that went after people, but after guns instead. Currently, the Castle Doctrine is in effect in 20 states, codified like we're trying to do today. 20 states, 8 states by case law. I don't hear any horror stories from those states from law enforcement officers. Law enforcement officers have nothing to be worried about in the Castle Doctrine. It hasn't proven out. And now I would like to be followed by Chief Todd Miller.
All right, Chief Miller, if you can. And please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Todd Miller. I'm the Director of Public Safety for the City of Mankato. I would like to tell you a little bit about my background in terms of what brings me here. I've been a chief of police since 1976 in 4 different states. Now 17 years in Minnesota after a 16 years and then a 6-year hiatus in which I was a chief of police in the state of Texas. My concern here in testifying in favor of the bill, there's many areas where we're getting cut back, and I cannot promise that to the citizens that we can be there every time to protect themselves, for us to protect them. I believe in the philosophy of community policing, and one of those philosophies says the police are the public are the police. The police are only those citizens who are paid to give full-time attention to the duties that are incumbent upon every citizen in the interest of community safety. That means we all have the same responsibility. We do it full-time. Citizens also are responsible for community safety. I do not fear a law-abiding citizen, a law-abiding gun owner. What I'm concerned about are the gang members, the drug dealers, especially coming out of the state of Texas, the people who, whenever an incident occurs, people will say, oh, how did that person get a gun? That person shouldn't have a gun for whatever impairment. Those are the people that I'm more concerned about, the people who are stealing the guns, etc. I think that what we're dealing with in this law change, for the first issue on the permits to purchase, I got a little bit different perspective. I certainly agree we need to send all information to the federal for the next check to make sure that the people who are not legal to have a gun don't get them, aren't allowed to buy them. I spent 7 years in a state where you did not have a permit to purchase. They utilized the next check. It was an instant check. If it's kept up to date, then the seller of that gun will know immediately as that person at the time, not he got his permit 8 months ago. My agency currently spends about 200 to 250 hours a year staff time to process permits to purchase. I support those extensions and what's in the bill, but I would come from a different perspective to say maybe let's make sure we support the federal system, the instant check, and utilize that. On the Castle Doctrine, again, I've had some experience in other states that I didn't see a carnage. I didn't see something that was a threat to my officers. In another state that I worked in, every person had the legal right without a permit to have a gun in their car at any time. My officers faced that potential all the time. It wasn't an issue. I am not aware of officers being shot in it. We can't promise everything. I can't say that 100% there will be none of the things in these tragedies that the people are mentioning. Can't say that 100% they won't occur. But for the most part, my experience has been that you're not going to see that with law-abiding gun owners trying to make decisions to protect themselves in their home.
Thank you, Chief.
I have a question.
We're going to hold questions, Representative Moran, until we're going to hold him until the end, and we can bring him back if you have a specific question for him. Thank you. I'm going to give up on trying to figure out who's next, Chair Cornish, and you can tell me who's next. And please state your name for the record, please, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor of law at Hamline University. I'm obviously not here on Hamline's benefit. I'm here because I'm president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance and their registered lobbyist. I had a hand in drafting this, so let me make a couple of things clear. If you take a look in Article 3 at the self-defense provisions, if you would look in Subdivision 1, there's some language that's stricken. That's the existing law. It's about 50 words. If you go down and look in Subdivision 2, where it says circumstances where authorized, voila, the stricken language reappears. The actual language that defines the defense is almost entirely copied from existing law. It's there in Subdivision 2, circumstances when authorized. The only thing that has been added is a provision that allows you to act when you're resisting or preventing what you reasonably believe, and reasonably believe does not mean what a drunk believes, does not mean what a drug dealer believes. Reasonable is the term that the law uses to define a reasonable person. It is an objective test. It is the very same words and the very same objective test that's in current law. And we add forcible felony. Why? Because these are crimes that have violence and force and harm and danger as elements of the offense. And if it's an element of the offense, then you as the defender have to figure it's going to happen. And this protects you in that case. Two, there is some language after the fight begins. Subdivision 3 deals with how you deal with the deadly battle when you're in the middle of it. Okay, there's no more time for detached and disinterested thinking. You're in a fight for your life. And what we do there is we have a somewhat subjective test. It says honestly or in good faith. You know where we got that? From section 7.08 of the existing Minnesota criminal jury instructions. That is the current law in Minnesota. It's just never appeared in the statute, but that is what the courts follow and what the courts do. It says you can meet force with superior force, that you can go one step or more up the continuum of force. That's exactly what police officers are taught to do. You don't win a fight by giving the aggressor equal terms. You win the fight by beating him. The same thing is true with the requirement of retreat. The last thing you want to do is turn your back on a deadly threat. In fact, the retreat rule, which the Minnesota Supreme Court invented out of thin air about 20 years ago, is the minority rule in America. Lefebvre's principles of criminal law make this very clear. It is the rule followed in the minority of states. Why? Because the majority of states have Supreme Courts that recognize that detached and disinterested thinking in the face of an upturned knife is simply not appropriate.
Mr. Olson?
So we don't require that.
You've exceeded your 2 minutes. I'm going to give you another 15-second warning here. The
15-second warning. I can do it in a 15-second warning. It doesn't say that the presumption is rebuttable because in Minnesota, under some law in the 645s, all presumptions are rebuttable. Can the police seize guns as evidence? Yes, they can. If you'll read the bottom of the section that authorizes the first subdivision in that section, that says specifically that they can. And the definition of deadly force is word for word from the Model Penal Code. It's nothing new. It's nothing unusual. It's nothing strange and weird. It's straight from the Model Penal Code. It's been adopted in a number of other states, and in fact a portion of it is in Minnesota law governing police use of deadly force.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Chair Cornish, do you have a...
Before we bring the next testifier up, somebody from the Brady Bunch had made a claim that I called her a liar. Nothing with the type was said at all. There were lies on the email. I didn't attribute them to anybody, but somebody was even quoting a different bill than this and making all sort of suppositions. That's why I didn't name the person so anybody wouldn't be tagged with that. So I didn't call anybody in specific a liar. And then, like Professor Olson says, police can seize weapons in a domestic. It says in there if it's a continuing investigation of a crime, any police officer could always say that there is a... in fact, that's one of the reasons when you leave, you could be investigating a crime or you are investigating a crime and you could take the weapon. It just barely says if there is no crime and all is okay that you have to give it back. You can't keep it forever in a storage locker that's done nowadays. So there are exceptions that they can do that. So,
and thank you, Chair Cornish. Do you have another testifier?
I think we could just close it down there as far as support. Just go into questions.
I think we've got one more person on the list here that may not be on your list, and that's Eric Pekaiser. And if you could state your name for the record, and hopefully it was close to what I said.
My name is Eric Pekaiser. I'm the training director for Quorum Security Incorporated, which is a Minnesota Citizens Personal Protection Act certified training organization here. I'm speaking on behalf of a supporter of the bill. Since the passage of the MCPPA, we've had a little over 81,000 people that acquired permits to carry. And I don't claim to speak for those people, but I strongly believe that they don't want people who cannot lawfully own guns to acquire them. And this bill will help accomplish that through the information sharing of the Department of Human Services and the greater oversight on the permit to purchase background checks. And this is something that our opponents claim that they want. And it surprises me to hear the St. Paul Police Chief, or a representative of the St. Paul Police Department here, speaking out against increased oversight of the permit process. The other benefit to this bill is the clarification of the self-defense law, as Professor Olson mentioned, including the duty to retreat. Currently, in order to understand our self-defense law, you have to navigate statutory and case laws, some of which there are conflictions, particularly between the defensive dwelling law and the existing deadly force justifications. I think it's important to understand, as others have said, this bill will not lower the threshold of self-defense. It will simply clarify and define it more clearly. As someone who teaches people to carry guns here in the state of Minnesota, been doing it since I moved here in 1997, even before the MCPPA was passed. I honestly would not change a lot of my training if this bill was passed. We teach permit holders to avoid trouble. We teach them to disengage if they're attacked, and we teach them to escape and evade their attacker. And we're not going to teach. I'm not going to teach anything different, and I don't think any of my colleagues are going to teach anything different. If this bill's passed. I will give you an example, though, from one of my students' own experiences of why I think this bill's necessary. I'm going to use the name David. It's not his real name. He's a gentleman. I've known him for over 10 years. Intelligent, reasonable, nonviolent person. He raises pet rabbits. And he also has a permit to carry a pistol. 2005, he was photographing a car parked in front of his house. It was a classic car. He thought it was a neat-looking car, so he took a picture of it. For reasons we're never able to determine, this enraged two strangers who attacked him in his front yard and demanded his camera. He tried to run for his front door. He was pinned against the side of his house and punched and kicked by two men that were twice his size. Despite crying for help, asking him to stop, leave him alone, the assault continued. He had nowhere to go, outnumbered by larger attackers, no sign the attack was going to stop, and he reasonably feared he was in immediate danger of death or great bodily harm. So he drew his gun and he ordered him back. After which they fled back to the street. He called 911 and reported. St. Paul police showed up and immediately arrested him at gunpoint, searched him, handcuffed him, put him in a squad car. He spent 3 days in the Ramsey County Jail with no access to an attorney, no medications which were necessary for a medical condition he had, sharing a cell with an accused criminal. After three long days and night, the Ramsey County attorney saw that, recognized this as a self-defense case and kicked him out of the jail with no charges. This is a man who never committed a crime in his life, went through the combination of being assaulted violently in his own front yard and then was incarcerated for 3 days. And I have to be honest, he still receives therapy for this today. It was a traumatic experience.
Mr. Beezer, you've exceeded 2 minutes, so there's your 15-second warning.
Thank you, sir. If this bill moves forward and is passed, rather than reinforcing a policy of arresting the gun, as St. Paul Police demonstrated in this case, they will have the discretion, with the evidence of self-defense, to release a person in a situation like this, rather than put them through what David went through. It reinforces the basic tenet of American justice that we're all innocent until proven guilty, and I encourage you to adopt it as it's written.
Thank you, Mr. Pekeser. And just for the clarification, especially for those in the audience, you mentioned the MCPPA. If you can just define that acronym for us.
Minnesota Citizens Personal Protection Act that was passed in 2003 and then repassed in 2005.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Pekeser.
Thank you.
Chair Cornish.
Before we get into questions, I just wanted to make sure that I respect my law enforcement people here for their opinions, but I want everybody to think about this. The Personal Protection Act, the chiefs, the sheriffs, the MPPA all testified against it. Law enforcement used some of the same claims they did here today. There would be, I think you've heard, road rage, husband-wife rage, domestics, this and that. When they described that, they did the same thing in the Personal Protection Act. However, none of the claims came true, none of them, on the Personal Protection Act. All the hoopla you heard in the House floor about blood running the streets, one sheriff said there will be more suicides on the first. All these claims were made, and now we've got a perfectly normal bill with thousands of people carrying without any incidents. Everything is fine. The public likes it, overwhelmingly approves it. And I think the same thing is happening here. A lot of hoopla, a lot of claims, a lot of absurdities, picking out a case here, a tragic case there, thinking it's going to happen carte blanche across the state. If this passes eventually, I believe the same thing will happen to the Personal Protection Act. A year or two from now, we'll sit back and wonder, what was all the fuss about? And with that, I'd open it up to any questions if people were.
Thank you, Chair Cornish. I've got Representative Moran on the list. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the police chief of Mankato.
Chief Miller, if you can come down.
Good morning, Chief Miller.
Good morning.
So you are originally from Texas?
No, I'm originally from Wisconsin. I've been a chief of police in Wisconsin, Iowa, 17 years in Minnesota, and 6 years in Texas.
Well, I heard you, Mr. Chair. Texas a lot.
From 2003 to 2010.
Is there a lot of crime and gang and drugs in Texas?
Chief Miller, just, and this is kind of, as we begin this questioning, it's a little bit different process. Just make sure that you go through the chair when you're asking to be recognized, and that way it's not a one-on-one conversation and the record can be accurate. So go ahead, Chief Miller.
Is there crime and drugs and things in Texas? Yes, there is.
Representative Moran?
So I'm going to assume that was maybe one of the reasons that the concealed carry became law, or...
Chief Miller?
I think that, I can't presume, I guess, to say why concealed carry in Texas became law, although there's a lot,
there's a lot of issues in Texas about rights and the limitation of rights of the government and a lot of personal freedoms.
Okay, Maria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How's the gangs and drugs and crime in Mankato?
Chief Miller?
Thankfully, we have a pretty peaceful city. We have less crime, certainly, in Mankato than in other communities that I have been a chief in.
Yeah, like most
Representative
of the...
Moran?
Like, Mr. Chair, thank you. I would say that's kind of most of the cities in Minnesota. It's not really heavy crime.
Go ahead, Representative Moran.
It's a statement. And so I'm not going to ask any more questions, but I wanted to make a statement because I have come to the place where I am convinced that police chief, you know, peace officers and, you know, any other law enforcement person, I mean, they serve no purpose. They come here, they testify about laws that we are introducing and passing through this committee that will call us to have unsafe streets, and we ignore them. We seem to not believe that they are putting their lives in jeopardy every day for the safety of everyday people, and we ignore them. Here we come again with a bill that my colleague, Representative Cornish, calls common sense, that I find no common sense at all about this bill. And it is about what is real and what is imagined. And in many ways, we're asking people to imagine in their head whether or not they feel intimidated, where they feel that their life is in jeopardy, and to make a decision about how they need to defend themselves. And our peace officer have no say-so in that part of it, because we're going to give individuals the power to make that choice. As a public safety committee, I mean, I'll come in here, I came here really believing that it was about creating safe streets for all of us. And it comes to, again, one of these my Republican colleagues about individual choice. Individual choice in your head whether or not you have the right to defend yourself and what that means and what that looks like. And it's just beyond me that we have come to a state, as, in my opinion, of seeing this to being the ultimate state of being paranoid. The ultimate state of being paranoid. The state of Minnesota, we are not where Texas is, or maybe where other states are. We are here in Minnesota. And I'm not to say that we do not have crime, drugs, or gangs. We do. But we also have law and peace officers, police chiefs, and others who are there to make those kind of decisions and to keep us safe. And so I ask members to not support this bill and turn over the law to individuals.
Thank you, Representative Moran. I would just, I guess, point out that law enforcement, just like any other constituent group, has a varied opinion about different things. And so I'm not too surprised that we hear from both sides of that, from law enforcement, on their opinions. They're, I think, like most Minnesotans, have opinions based on their experiences, and those opinions are valid on both sides of that issue. Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chair, just to reinforce that, I think that I don't expect somebody to believe me just because I have a badge on. In fact, Representative Moran, you have rejected the ideas of two police that came here. I don't think that you believed Sheriff Stanek when he testified on the immigration law, and I don't think anybody there believed on that side the longtime investigator that came to us to Worthington begging for help on illegal documents. There was no support. And in fact, they thought it was a terrible bill that he was begging for help from law enforcement. So sometimes we have different opinions. Sometimes we agree with cops, and sometimes we don't. And it's like if an attorney comes up here, the Bar Association might say one thing and a separate attorney the other. So I would just encourage you to use your best wits and sort it out for yourself.
Mr. Chair, point of order.
Sure, Representative Gaultier.
I think we need to have civil debate, and I have heard several times getting close to impugning members or testifiers, and I just want to remind members that we can have civil debate and disagree. But I don't think it's my job or anybody else on this committee to question or to counteract what another member is believing or saying, and I think we need to use judicial use of the chair and be respectful.
Thank you, Representative Gaultier. I would say that that's true on both sides here, and I am very impressed, actually, with this debate this morning. I think it has been very reasoned, and I think we've allowed both sides to have their points, and so I will take that under advisement, and I appreciate that, Representative Gaultier. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to Chair Cornish, you know, I understand why you want to minimize the comments of the professional law enforcement organizations, because they have some very strong things to say about the kind of bill you're presenting here. And to compare individual law enforcement officials with professional organizations, I think, is a bit of a stretch. I mean, I belong to probation officers organization. We come together and put together certain beliefs and notions about what we want to move forward, but there might be individual probation officers that have their own rogue ideas about what should happen. That doesn't make the two equal. The professional organization is based on opinions and ideas that are well thought out and researched for the organization. I mean, there's quite a difference. And what do these organizations say? Minnesota Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police, the Minnesota Police and Police Officers Association, they call it overly broad and confusing, putting police officers at risk, a recipe for disaster that would cause immeasurable harm. These are coming from our professional organizations. I mean, you could say whatever you want, but these are the people who work together within a system of thinking about these issues and come together and state their opinions. This isn't just flippant ideas. So I think that's one particular point. I think one thing that needs to be said over and over again, and tell me if you disagree with this, but the state already provides the right for an individual to protect themselves with deadly force in public or in their home. Is that true?
Representative Cornish? Chair Cornish?
The way I guess our way that would answer that is I don't think that you should give you an example.
It's just a yes or no, Mr. Chair. It's just a yes or no answer. I'm not looking for a long
comment. No, I'm giving you
long comment. It's just a yes or no. Is that true?
I'm not
Representative Johnson,
if you want to.
We'll allow Chair Cornish to answer the question.
So, anyway, I'll give you this example. It's not a yes or no question. Say they a woman or a child or a man and his child were in the house and they hear a breaking of a window or something ruckus downstairs and somebody's come into their house. Why should they have to wait till somebody picks up their TV, a commission of a felony, or comes, walks across the floor and grabs the woman or child before they take action? What this bill does is give people more latitude. And I didn't minimize law enforcement's opinion at all. You know, sometimes we accept law enforcement's opinion, sometimes we don't. They came up to the table admitting they were divided. And furthermore, you know, different organizations think different. The conservation officers, when I was president of their union, I took a survey and they were totally against the types of gun controls that the other law enforcement organizations purported. So I haven't minimized law enforcement at all. I just happened to disagree with some of them, like you saw the other chief did, too.
That's fine, Mr. Chair, but in fact, they are quite united. They're not divided. You might have your own opinion and be divided, but they are, in fact, united in a particular point. And just to restate, the fact is the state already does provide the right for individuals to protect themselves with deadly force in the public, in public or in their home, and that's a fact. And another fact is that there have been no cases of a person being charged when they were defending themselves under current law in Minnesota. Isn't that correct?
Yes. Repeat the last one again.
There have been no cases of a person being charged when they were defending themselves under current law in Minnesota. Can you cite me a case where that's different?
I haven't researched that.
Well, in fact, that's the case.
You mean I, right offhand, to pull one out of the air? No.
Representative Johnson?
And lastly, do you have a fiscal note for this bill? I mean, there's costs throughout this
Chair
bill.
And Representative Johnson, I think we've ordered one.
Well, it seems to me, you know, we have a $5 billion deficit in this state. We're taking precious time spending on this very controversial bill. And even when We have the bill before us, and we've had all this time. We still don't have a fiscal note to review the cost. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. We should have had the fiscal note before us to review in this bill, in this committee. This is a fiscal committee.
Representative Johnson, I'm going to have Mr. Carter address that. Mr. Carter, do you have some additional insight on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, there, a fiscal note was ordered last week with a due date, I believe, of today, but it has not been completed yet.
Representative Johnson?
Well, I appreciate that, but again, we've got 3 weeks left to go to session. We have a $5 billion deficit that's not getting resolved, and we have a very controversial bill here without a fiscal note. That's a problem.
I don't think I'm going to answer that, but next question.
Thank you. Representative Creasel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Creasel, I'm sorry, just before you get started, just a reminder, we've got 10 minutes until committee end, and we have eight bills on the agenda. I know we're not going to get to all eight bills in the next 10 minutes, but just as a reminder.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative Cornish for bringing this up. I think this is an important bill. As a father, as a husband, it's a duty to me to protect my house, protect my family. And there was an example brought up earlier about, well, someone's in your house or someone's in your garage rummaging around. It might just be a teenager. I couldn't live with myself if I said, you know what, I'm not going to do anything. Maybe they're just here to get a beer out of my fridge or something of that sort. If they're in my house, they're not supposed to be there. It's my job to protect my family, and this is important. This bill sends a message to criminals, and I believe it will act as a deterrent. This is a public safety issue. Don't break into a house, and this is, you're not going to get hurt. It's a novel idea. Thank you.
Representative Leidiger, you're last on the list here.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Maury? Okay. We'll put you after Representative Leidiger.
Well, I just will make a comment then, Mr. Chair. You know, I think we're very fortunate to live in Minnesota. We have excellent education, great work ethic. When I was in the Navy, I used to love to have people come in from this state, the state of Wisconsin. When you go around the world and you go to different countries, you see kids with machine guns that are in the road, that are at checkpoints. I think we have a phenomenal citizenry that is mature enough to be able to handle this kind of a bill. Nowhere else in the world do you have a better environment. And I think that has to be taken into consideration. I fully support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Leidiger. Representative Maury.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cornish, or Chair Cornish, the reason you don't know of any cases in Minnesota that they've been convicted is because there aren't any. I'm going to make a few points since both sides have been not asking questions, they've been making points. With regard to Mr. Olson's testimony, I actually checked it out in the law. You said there's overcoming presumptions in Chapter 645. So I looked up Chapter 645. There are two provisions, 1.7 and 2.1, which relate to presumptions. One is with regard to legislative intent. It has nothing to do with overcoming a presumption. The other one is a presumption against retroactive effect on criminal laws, which is also in the U.S. Constitution. I'll tell you my instance, how bad this bill is. I was at a National Conference of State Legislators meeting, and I got to the hotel there at about little after midnight, delayed by the weather. I go down, check in, I'm giving the key, it's not a key anymore, it's a key card. I go down, put it in the door, go in the room, and I start putting stuff on the shelves, my briefcases. I hear groaning. There's a couple in there sleeping. Under this bill, they can shoot me. No question, right off. So I'm dead. Now, that would be handy because I couldn't argue against some of Representative Cornish's bills. But at the same time, I wouldn't like that. Police in Minneapolis tell me that this is just, there's a lot of times when somebody even goes into the wrong apartment house and doesn't realize, I mean, not apartment house, apartment, doesn't realize it. But what are we, someone in testimony brought up, a lot of mentally ill people do things that a person wouldn't necessarily think, in our, so we're going to execute them for that. I just, it's kind of appalling. Another thing that Mr. Olson said was that there's exact same language, but there isn't. There's different language in that if you even read it. The reality of the presumption now, when you make it a presumption and can only be overcome by proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the person didn't believe what he says he believes, how can you prove that I don't believe what I say I believe? There's no standard there other than no standard. So it's an impossibility. You are just creating something that can't be overcome. Another point about this, and the one of, I think it was the head of the chiefs, brought it up about Article 4 when we bring in allowing permits from other states. The only one I can think of right offhand of a murder I know of by a permit holder in Minnesota is the one where the person had a permit from another state. And we heard earlier in the session the Bloomington police officer who's in charge of permits say there was 170 people in just in Bloomington in 1 year that were denied under our standards, many because of severe mental illness. Those people would not have been prevented from having them here. So under this new bill, I mean, would not have been prevented from having guns. So there's just, I'm trying to hit the points that haven't been hit by other members on my side. There's huge problems with this bill, and I certainly hope this doesn't become law because it's scary.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morning, Chair Cornish.
Just shortly, I guess we could go tit for tat between attorneys here. In short, I don't agree with one of the points that you've made, and you've addressed parts in the bill that aren't even here about background checks. This strengthens background checks, and 38 states don't even have a permit to purchase of handguns, and so I think we're doing okay here. We're one of the few states that do have and we're strengthening in this bill the information that goes in, and this bill does not allow you to kill somebody without reason, and they are rebuttable, and it is there is a certain reasonableness in there. You can't just shoot somebody for without a reason. There's nothing in that bill that allows you to do that, so it's just it's misfact. And then lastly, law enforcement was wrong on the Personal Protection Act. They were united. They were united and wrong. They're united here and wrong. So, okay.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think just because we've, you know, both sides have put in so much stock in what law enforcement said, I'd just like to make a comment. Representative Johnson, you said that just because the association made a statement that's what we're supposed to accept. But using that logic, I would suggest we don't have a $5.2 billion budget anymore, because we as a legislature, you and I, and the House and the Senate voted, and we've passed a budget bill. So that must be your stamp of approval. But I don't think I'll make that stretch, because I don't believe you probably believe that way. But that's our association. We are the legislature. We've passed that. So we've made that statement. But you certainly have your own opinion. We've heard from the association, but we heard from different law enforcement. I think the most we can get out of today's testimony is that there's a differing of opinions. Some law enforcement are for it, some are against it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, point, I did ask the CA for a roll call, but I just want to make sure that on record that there is.
Thank you, Representative Moore. There will be a roll call being requested. There will be a roll call on this bill. Is there any further discussion? I have no one else on the list.
Representative Moran, where are you at? Just, and you know this, we're at the noon hour. Go ahead, Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a quick statement to Representative Creso over there that this law goes beyond someone coming into your house or your garage. It is way beyond that purpose. We already have a law on books about that. But this is way beyond intimidation, you feeling uncomfortable, walking down the street. I mean, it's just wide open.
Okay. Chair Cornish, any closing remarks regarding your bill and then renew your motion?
I'd like to renew my motion. House File 1467 be recommended to pass and move to the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee.
Okay. Chairman Cornish renews his motion that House File 1467 be passed and recommended to the House Judiciary. A roll call being requested. A roll call vote will be done on House File 1467. Warren?
Cornish.
Yes.
Woodard.
Yes.
Mullery.
No.
Gauthier.
No.
Grünhagen. Hilty.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Kelly.
Yes.
Kiefer.
Yes.
Creso.
Yes.
Leidiger.
Yes.
Mariani.
No.
McDonald.
Yes.
Moran.
No.
Norness.
Yes.
Slocum. Smith.
Yes.
Grünhagen.
Here.
Just say yes.
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 What do I do now?
Yes.
Are you voting on the bill?
Roll call vote on House File 1467, Representative Grünhagen.
Yes, but I wanted to make a comment, but I don't know.
No.
Oh,
no.
We will not take a roll call vote on whether or not Representative Grünhagen will be allowed to do that.
Right. There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, House File 1467 passes and is re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. The rest of the agenda will be carried over into tomorrow, and we'll be at 10:15 a.m. in State Office Building, Room 5. This meeting is adjourned.